Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
The FT.
What can investors expect from 2014? Why isn't the government's Help to Buy scheme available for all properties? And are expensive cars, watches and Chinese art a better bet than stock markets? I'm Elaine Moore, welcoming you to the first FT Money podcast of the new year, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues Lucy Warwick-Ching.
Hello.
Thomas Hale.
Hello.
And Jonathan Ely. First up, how helpful is Help to Buy? The government's flagship scheme is supposed to help people onto the property ladder, but some borrowers might find that they have trouble purchasing a new build property using the new mortgage guarantees. According to the Treasury, the guarantee scheme is available for all kinds of properties, but many lenders appear to be setting their own limits to it. Thomas Hale has been looking at the controversy. Thomas, there's lots of confusion about the difference between Help to Buy 1, Help to Buy 2. I find it very confusing. Maybe you find it confusing as well. Can you clear it up? Give me a succinct example of what they both are.
Okay, yeah, there is a lot of confusion. Help to Buy 1 is restricted to new build properties. It's the key difference. So you put down 5% deposit. The government lends you 20% interest-free for 5 years, and the bank lends the other 75%. With Help to Buy 2, which launched more recently, it was supposed to launch this month, but it was moved earlier to October, the government will guarantee 15% of the loan. This means lenders can lend bigger amounts, up to 95%, without jacking the rates up as much as they would have had to have done. So when you think of Help to Buy 2, think of the guarantee. When you think of Help to Buy 1, think of shared equity. You have shared equity with the government on Help to Buy 1. But there is a lot of confusion about Help to Buy. I mean, just for example, I saw an advert recently saying a Help to Buy is here, we're here to help, and had a list of properties below, most of them about £900,000. The maximum value on Help to Buy is £600,000. So it's become a buzzword in the media, and a lot of confusion has spread around that.
So even the industry perhaps is slightly confused about what it is and what it can and can't do. So explain to me the controversy about the sorts of loans that you can get for different sorts of properties. Are there no lenders giving loans through Help to Buy 2 for new builds?
Okay, well, just to be clear, I wouldn't say it's exactly a controversy as of yet. Some people say it's no issue at all, and there are arguments why it might not be, but others disagree. But basically, there are some lenders giving loans for Help to Buy 2 for new builds. RBS and NatWest are offering them, but the figures are fairly small. They say they've only had 65 applications for new build homes via Help to Buy 2, and that's about 2,500 in total, and 35 of these have been approved. Halifax, another big Help to Buy lender, don't offer Help to Buy 2 loans for new builds, and the reason they give for this is that they already offer 95% mortgages on new builds through New Buy, which was another government scheme designed to encourage supply, encourage development.
Just to make things extra complicated.
So so basically Halifax are saying that they don't need to offer Help to Buy 2 for new builds because they already have this scheme in place. But interest in New Buy has really fallen off since Help to Buy came in. I mean, Help to Buy is really, as I say, the buzzword around residential property now.
So there are other schemes around. Why then would I bother buying a new build property through Help to Buy 2 if I can do it through other schemes?
Yeah, well, that is a good question. Research from the Yorkshire Building Society last year showed that a lot of people feel very put off by the shared equity scheme, the shared equity part of Help to Buy 1. So in Help to Buy 1, the government basically owns 20% of your property. When you sell it, they take 20% of the profits if you haven't paid off the interest-free loan yet. But another key point here, and a lot of people are saying this isn't really an issue now, but it could become an issue in the future, because Help to Buy 1, just for new build properties, will finish before Help to Buy 2, at least 9 months earlier, but possibly more. So those using Help to Buy after the end of Help to Buy 1 might want to get a new build property through Part 2, but the general trend now is that lenders aren't really keen on doing this.
And you said before that there are some people who say there's no controversy. What are brokers saying, or who's saying there is controversy?
Well, I mean, generally people are saying this is more a point of interest or a good talking point about Help to Buy rather than a controversy. But some brokers I've spoken to are very, very surprised. And others say that, again, it isn't really an issue now, but if it does become an issue, it will be in the future when Help to Buy 1 ends. Then we may have a situation where Help to Buy as a scheme is only existing for the purchase of existing houses. Now, a key thing to remember here is that most people in industry agree the major problem with UK residential properties is the lack of supply. There's not enough house building going on. And so if we have this scheme which has attracted a lot of interest, a lot of media attention, and at some point in the future it's only really operating in a meaningful sense for existing properties, then there is a clear risk that developers might be anxious about this.
Thank you very much, Tom. There's more on the pros and cons of the government's Help to Buy scheme, parts 1 and 2, in this weekend's FT Money, which you can also read via the FT's tablet apps on Kindle and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, the rise and rise of passion investments. First, what can investors expect from 2014? After the exuberance of 2013, world stock markets have got off to a tentative start this year. As extraordinary monetary policy starts to wind down, however slowly, investors are pondering whether the economic recovery is strong enough to keep company earnings growing in the face of higher borrowing costs. And there's still the vast overhang of government debt to deal with. This week, FT Money held a roundtable of investment experts to discuss the outlook for stock markets and other investments in 2014. I'm joined now by Jonathan Ely, editor of FT Money and your usual Money podcast host, who chaired the panel along with some of the participants. Jonathan, what did you all talk about?
Well, we talked about all sorts of things. We talked about the outlook for the US markets in the light of the Federal Reserve's decision to start reducing its bond purchases. We talked about emerging markets. We talked, and we could have talked all day, in fact, about the phenomenon that is Bitcoin. But one of the most interesting elements of the discussion was the debate about Europe, and in particular, the sort of core of Europe, France, Germany, Italy. Now, to some people, this represents a sort of enormous value trap. There's lots of complacency. There are still huge risks to the structure and existence of the Eurozone. And to other people, it represents a great opportunity. European shares are still fairly cheap, and some level of stability and even growth appears to have returned. Now, I'm joined now by Anne Richards, who's Chief Investment Officer at Aberdeen Asset Management, and by Ewan Cameron-Watt, who is Chief Investment Strategist at the BlackRock Investment Institute. Ewan, if I can ask you first, this idea that there's a huge amount of complacency around the Eurozone, and that someday it's all going to unravel and it's all going to collapse and we're going to be in for a very nasty, rude awakening. What do you think of that? Is it likely next year or at any point?
Well, I think, Jonathan, that Europe's economic problems are by no means over. They've moved to a different phase, as seen through the strength of the currency. I don't think you can say there is a euro crisis at this stage. We've now moved into a phase where the peripheral countries, whilst they're struggling with desperately high unemployment, have at least righted their funding flows, where European banks continue to shrink their balance sheets and yet are able to raise capital in the market, so their funding ratios are improving. And where, you know, perhaps the most acute phase of the crisis for now has passed. But, you know, if European economic growth in the next 5 years is 1% to 2% per annum, which is about as good as one can believe it's going to be, European debt levels relative to GDP will continue to rise because that growth isn't high enough relative to the cost of funds to actually result in a net reduction in debt.
And Anne Richards, there's this idea that actually if you buy European shares, you're not really buying a play on the Eurozone or the French economy or the Italian economy. You're buying a collection of companies that sell products across the world. And actually, those companies are pretty cheap right now. What do you say to that argument?
I think that argument is, if pretty cheap might be an overstatement, but certainly you can still find good value in a lot of European companies. And Europe is fortunate that it has a lot of truly international companies which operate at the highest level, at the highest quality level all around the world. They've been continuing to grow and in many cases been continuing to expand their margins even through the crisis. And I think what that does is it demonstrates that companies, well-managed companies, are able to insulate themselves to a degree from a sluggish economic backdrop. And I think broadly we think that pattern is likely to continue. But there's no doubt that some of the challenges that Europe still has, and in particular this split that we have now, not even between into a two-tier Europe, but really into a three-tier Europe, where you have Germany at the top end, you have the depressed but perhaps beginning to recover periphery countries at the bottom end, Spain and Greece, for example. But then in the middle, France and Italy, who are at risk of being the real drag in Europe over the next couple of years. And I think those markets do matter for even the more international of European companies. So I think that might be something of a challenge if we don't see real progress being made at some point in France and Italy.
And finally, do you think there's a danger that the euro is all going to blow up this year and that we'll have another, you know, sort of crisis of the type we had in 2011?
I don't think that's a strong likelihood in 2014. The caveat to that would be if we have an unexpected crisis in an individual bank or financial institution in Europe, which might just create an element of fear again in the market. You've seen spreads come in a long way. So you've seen much more confidence come back in the European system. So outside of an unexpected banking crisis, I think you're unlikely to see Eurozone problems flare up again this year. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that they have been healed for all eternity. There are still some big structural imbalances within the Eurozone.
Finally, Ewan, for many years, people have said, well, why on earth is the euro so strong in the sort of face of all the problems that Europe faces? Do you think that the currency will weaken this year? And if so, would that provide a fillip to European companies, which are very heavily export dependent?
I think that the euro has been strong because Europe runs a current account surplus, which means it doesn't need to import any capital from outside Europe. And Europeans, on the whole, have held on to the euro as a source of value. So they haven't felt the need to switch to non-euro holdings, on the whole. I think in 2014, it really depends on what the dollar does, because Europe will run another current account surplus this year, 2014, as it did in 2013. But I don't think euro is going to strengthen a lot, because in 2013, at the beginning of the year, let's remember, the euro crisis was on everybody's lips, and by the end of the year it wasn't. As Anne says, you know, that could come back again. But assuming it doesn't, and I'd give that a low probability in all honesty right now, then I think maybe the currency, the single currency, actually drifts down a little bit against the dollar because the dollar itself strengthens a bit, as it has done against all other currencies, major currencies in 2013 other than sterling. Now, does that help European companies? It helps to the extent that it just reduces the pressure of what I call the euro corset, which has been suffocating monetary conditions and liquidity in Europe. It does help companies a little bit at the margin, although European companies have lost quite a lot of competitiveness relative to, say, Japan in the last year or so. I think it's just more a loosening of European financial conditions, which makes itself felt in a stronger equity market, which would be the outcome of a slightly weaker euro.
Okay, thank you both very much. That was Anne Richards of Aberdeen Asset Management and Ewan Cameron-Watt of the BlackRock Investments Institute.
Thanks, Jonathan. You can read a detailed transcript of this discussion in this week's FT Money or online at ft.com/money. On to our final item for today. Returns on classic cars, art and watches have exceeded stock markets for the past 8 years, according to the private bank Coutts. And of all these so-called passion investments, it's classic cars that have returned the most. They're up by 257% since 2005. Lucy Warwick-Ching, our resident expert on all things luxurious, has been looking into the numbers. Lucy, first of all, let's go through passion investments. They sound very glamorous, are they?
What people like is they like to invest in something that they can physically own. You know, I think people have got very bored with the fact that, you know, no one's getting any return on their money in savings. Investments seem to be quite unpredictable. Very wealthy individuals quite like the fact that they can put money into a classic car. They can own it. They can show people it. They can kind of show off with it. And actually, if they invest right, they could actually make some money out of it.
But what would you consider a passion investment? Can we go through a list?
So it's things like classic cars, it's art, watches, jewellery, anything that is kind of luxury asset. I mean, I would probably include things like wine as well. It's things that you could actually collect them, you know, you could actually have a hobby and then turn it into a bit of an investment. And it has seemed that over the last few years, as returns on other investments have gone down or just stayed very boring and stable, that the interest in this has really taken off. You know, people have really started to look into whether they can make money from these alternative asset markets.
And do we know why they've taken off? Do we know who's buying them?
Well, yeah, I think, again, people have wanted to take a little bit more control over their money. So people like to, you know, own property as well. So, you know, very, very high-end property. Whereas instead, people were investing in kind of commercial property funds. Now people are actually saying, well, look, let's get together with a couple of us and buy a property outright. And then we can actually see exactly what our money's doing. I think they've just lost a bit of trust in financial services industry, and they just want to have much more control over where their money's going.
And do we know why they're doing so well?
Well, I guess it's, you know, interest breeds interest and demand breeds demand. So, you know, as more people want to buy these kind of niche works of art, then you're obviously going to get more of a higher demand, and you're going to be able to command a much higher price for these things.
And do you find that people are actually using these products, or they're just purely holding them in a basement somewhere as an investment?
And the impression I've got from our readers when I've written about this before is that they're not just buying them and holding them and keeping them hidden. They tend to have a real interest in them anyway. And I would also recommend that from speaking to the experts themselves, they say don't bother getting into one of these markets unless you are actually interested in it.
And finally, how can you go about buying these kinds of investments? Is it easy? Do you have to have vast amounts of money?
I think the problem is that you want to, if you are going to hold them, then you want to diversify. So you do need quite a lot of money. You don't just want to buy one type of car if you're looking to make an investment of it. So yes, you probably wouldn't look to do it if you didn't have quite a large amount of money that you wanted to spend. And then you'll go to these kind of niche markets. There are kind of niche brokers, so you can kind of look it up on the internet, and they have indices that track exactly what's happening. You know, it would say with Coutts, they've got this passion investments index that you can actually look at and see how it's been outperforming. But I mean, I guess the caveat is that with all these markets, you know, there could be just one little thing that happens and then it will totally skew the market. You've got to be prepared to lose money. You know, I guess what people always say with wine, you know, buy it because you want to drink it, because actually, you know, if your investment goes down, then, you know, at least you could still get enjoyment out of this asset.
Thanks very much, Lucy. That's a happy way to end the podcast this week. Lucy, as you may or may not know, is the producer of The Money Show, as well as a frequent guest on it. And this is her last week before she heads off on maternity leave. We're going to miss her very much while she's gone, and we're looking forward to welcoming her back when we're expecting her to be an expert on investing for children. There's more on passion investments in this weekend's FT Money, along with a host of other stories, and we'd love to hear your views. You can leave comments at the foot of stories on our website, or you can email us directly. The address, once again, money@ft.com. Until next week, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Lucy, Tom and Jonathan.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex.
Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.